And there you go. This meeting is now being recorded. I'm going to ask folks to place themselves on mute unless they are talking. If we're having too much background noise, we can mute you, but I would prefer to give people power over their own mute buttons. So please use them responsibly. The other thing I'm going to do before we get started with the actual meeting is give a couple pointers about how to use the meeting technology and also do a little roll call of who's on the meeting so we can make sure we're clear about which names go with which people, which phone numbers are connected with which people, and just so everybody knows who's on the line. Margaret at Echo Northwest, Margaret Ryman, who you guys have not met in person, but has been working on this project with us. She is going to be helping me manage the technology. You can also send a message, a chat message to her. We'll explain how to do that in a moment. But she's going to help me explain how to operate some of this. I'm going to go ahead and place everybody on mute right now while I run through how to do this, and then I'll go ahead and give you back control. Okay, I've muted everyone. You do have the ability to unmute yourself, and I'll unmute everybody in a moment. So what I'm going to have, Margaret's going to give a little introduction to how to use some of the features on this. And then I'm going to run through and I'll sort of call on each one of the names or phone numbers that I see listed and have you tell us who you are and make sure we know if you're a member of the PAC or a member of the public, and then just have you let us know how you've connected so that we can make sure that if there are folks that don't have access to these features that Margaret's going to describe in a moment, that we are aware of that and can make sure you have an opportunity to speak. Margaret, so can you go ahead and introduce folks to how they can use the chat and raise hands mm-hmm. features?
Yep. So if you're using the app, you should have a black bar at the bottom. And there is a button that says participants. If you click on that button, it should open a panel. And so you should see a list of names down the right-hand side. And then at the very bottom, there'll be a button called raise hand. And it's a button in blue text, a gray button. So if you want to test that out right now, you can do that. And we should start to see some hands raised. Yep, perfect. Looks good. All right, so we'll use that feature for the presenters and we'll monitor that so that when you have a question, like Becky said, you can use that feature. The other one-
This is the equivalent of, sorry, Margaret, this is the equivalent of placing your place card on its side to let us know that you would like to speak without interrupting. And if folks that don't have access to that feature, we're going to pause pretty frequently for questions and comments. So you should not have to wait too long, and we'll make sure you get an opportunity to speak, committee members who might not have access to the raise hand feature.
Great. And then the other feature that most folks have with the app is the chat feature, and that's also in the same spot. If you click on chat, you should have the option to either chat with Becky or myself. Right, Becky, did we turned off the other options?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you can use that to communicate with us if you're having connection issues or just tech issues. I'll be monitoring that most closely while Becky is helping present. So if you want to directly message me, so I just got a message from Bob Parker. Thanks, Bob, for testing that out. And I can chat with you on the side to help resolve some of that. And you can also use the email that Becky sent out if you're not on the app, if you need to communicate with me. think that's it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So now I'm going to give you back control over your muting and unmuting. And I'm going to just go through and have you tell us. I'm going to start with folks that are, I see on here as a phone number. And if you did not enter a participant ID when you called in, but you did join on the online or on the app, then you'll show up as just a phone number for us. And we just want to know, make sure we are connecting those to who people are so we can kind of just keep track. So I'm going to start with 206-459-4290. Can you go ahead and say your name and whether you're a member of the PAC or the public, and then if you are connected just on the phone or if you're also on the app or browser?
Marjorie Liddell on iPhone, member of the committee.
Okay. And as we go, Margaret's going to update your display name and she's got our committee roster in front of us. But if we do get your name wrong, you can always send her a note in chat. So thank you, Marjorie, we've got you. And now you have control over your own mute button, so use it wisely, thank you. 360-566-7735. Can we get your name and who you are? You might be on mute on your end. I've unmuted you. Okay, we'll come back. 360-600-7301. Who's that?
Hi, Becky. It's Colette.
Okay. Hi, Colette. And I see you are on, we've got you on in two places, which is just fine. That's why we want to check so we know who's who. Thank you. And 360-887-6132. Can I get your name and whether you're PAC or public?
Susan Rasmussen, member of the public.
Okay, thank you. And are you connected on the screen share as well, or are you just joining us by phone?
Nope, I'm on both.
Okay, great, thank you. You must be the Susan that I see down below. So Margaret, there's a Susan down below. I think that's our same Susan, both places. And then I've got Bob Parker with Echo Northwest, who folks know. Bob Poole with Clark County, who folks also know. Brian, I am guessing this is Brian Snodgrass. Can you confirm?
I'm here if you can hear me.
Yep. Is that Brian Snodgrass, City of Vancouver?
It is. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, you have control over your own mute button. Chris Cook, who is our county, I almost said city attorney, our county's attorney, is on the line as well.
Hello.
Eric Galamo. Hi. Eric Galamo, yep. I think we've got your name clear.
Can you hear me there?
Yep, we can hear you. Thanks. You've got control over your own mute button. James Malinowski, Jim, committee member, can we make sure we can hear you? You must be on mute on your end because I'm not able to unmute you.
I'm not sure if you guys know, but if you hold down your space bar, it's like a talk button.
That's a nice trick that I actually did not know. Thank you for sharing. Jim Malinowski, we'll let you.
Well, wait a second. Now I think
there you
I
are.
Okay.
Thank you. Great. Whatever you did, that's your system.
Should I mute on the computer or on my phone?
Either one works. It will. If you mute it on the computer, it will mute your phone if you have connected them together. So either one works. If you mute in both places, just remember that you've done that so that you can unmute in both places when you do want to talk.
I'll use my phone.
Okay, great. And are you, you're seeing the screen share as well? You were able to install the program?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Jeff Swanson, member of the PAC, are you, there we go, and are you connected via the app today?
Just the app, yes.
Okay, great. Jerry, is that Jerry Olson from our committee?
Yes, Jerry Olson.
Okay, and are you on phone only, or do you have the screen share as well?
I have both, and I didn't get where I showed to raise my hand.
Are you connected just through a browser?
No, I have.
Or on the app?
Monitor at work.
Did you connect through the link to the browser, or did you download software to connect?
I downloaded software.
Okay. Maybe you can send Margaret a note, and she might be able to help you out with that as we keep going.
Okay.
Thank you. And then John Blum, I'm assuming this is our Councillor Blum. I think I've unmuted you, but you might have to unmute yourself. There you go.
Is this better?
Yep, can hear you now, thank you. Okay, Jose, you guys, everybody knows Jose, obviously, our county project manager. Ryan Davis on our committee. And it looks like you've got access through the app, is that right?
Yep, that's it.
Okay, you're a little faint and hard to hear, but I could hear you. Just if you are going to, if you do have a comment, make sure you're close to your mic so we can hear you.
Sounds good.
Thanks. Ryan McInster on our committee. Apologies if I said your last name incorrectly.
That's close enough. I'm on the app or on the computer.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Colette, we've got. Oliver is Oliver on as well? It looks like he's on, but I don't know if he's connected to the audio. And then Ron Barca, I see that you are, I see your note and that we have your name. So Margaret, the 360 number that we had at the top is Ron Barca from our committee as well, who is also showing up down below. Okay, so I think that's everybody. And so with that, now that I think we've more or less got somewhat the hang of how this is gonna work, I'm gonna turn it to Jose to start our actual meeting. And thank you for bearing with us through a new world of using technology for this.
Hi, everybody, thanks for joining us. I hope you and your families are doing well. Let's see, the update is, Councillor Blum, do you have anything to add before we begin? I wanted to check in with you.
No, nothing specific. Just want to thank everyone for their flexibility and recognize that while these are certainly trying times, appreciate everyone's willingness to stay involved in this process and keep it moving forward. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. This is project so far has been a lot of technological issues that we've had to deal with. Again, thank you for joining us and bear with us. Becky mentioned we're going to be, we are recording this. And with that, I think we can get started.
All right. So the first order of business, I think we have, Margaret, check me on this, but it looks like we've got a quorum here. Congratulations, that we're getting enough people on our online meeting. So first order of business is our summary from meeting two. And the question is, did anybody have a clarification or correction that they would like to offer to the meeting two summary? Okay, hearing none. Next question is, does anybody object to approving the meeting summary as written? We're not going to do quite our usual formal vote on this, but if anyone has objections to the meeting summary, to approving the meeting summary as is, any PAC members, please speak up now.
Yeah.
Was that a yes objection or a background noise? Apologies, I'm a little hard to tell. Okay, I'm going to take that for background noise. Folks that are on the phone, if you could make sure to put yourself on mute. I want to make sure that you're able to speak up if you need to, but if there's too much background noise, I will have to mute the phone. Okay, so I'm going to consider our meeting two summary approved as is. This meeting, we are going to follow up on what we presented last time on residential land classifications. We have done a little bit more work on those and have a few updates to share, have refined our recommendations to reflect your input. So we have a little more on those. The commercial and industrial classifications and the redevelopment parts we're going to come back to at a future meeting. And then this meeting, we're also introducing market factor and infrastructure gaps. So we'll get to those following the wrap-up of residential land classifications. So on the residential land classifications, I'm going to give just a quick run-through of reminder of our current approach. The county's current approach in the VBLM, and then any updates and refined recommendations. So the current approach here is that lots that are under 5,000 square feet are considered built for vacant land. And the platted lots that are larger than 5,000 square feet are getting grouped with larger vacant parcels that have not yet been subdivided. So the recommendation, our refined recommendation based on your feedback, we had discussed most of this at the last meeting, was that parcels that are between 1,000 square feet and an acre that have been platted within the last 20 years and meet all the other criteria for vacant land would be put into a new classification for vacant platted lots. And when we get to the capacity piece of that, there would be one unit per lot assumed. So not doing other deductions, not applying density assumptions, et cetera. Any questions or comments about that? That's pretty consistent with what we discussed. I think the only update is that we had talked about sort of over what period we would be looking back, and the project team's recommendation was to look back over a rolling 20-year period from the date of the VBLM. So any questions or comments about that recommendation? I see Jim Malinowski. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, why are you living in it? Oops, I just did something wrong here. The 20 years, why are you going back 20 years? Why only go back 20 years? That's my question.
Yeah, why only go back 20 years? So the reasoning to go back 20 years is for older flats, it's more likely that I guess a replat is more likely. You're more likely to have a situation where the current zoning and development potential might not match the size of lot that was platted. So that was the rationale for having just within the last 20 years was to focus on things that are sort of probably consistent with their current zoning and maybe they're part of a sort of semi-recent plat. They're not that likely to get further divided. Does that answer your question?
Well, I'm not sure. I there may be someone else that can bring that up, but I've heard that there have been problems where the county has blocked development on legal lots that were established well before 20 years ago. And, you know, those of us in the rural area don't think that's reasonable.
Jose, maybe you can clarify. We're not talking about what would actually be allowed as far as where development would be allowed, but just which ones we are grouping with vacant platted versus grouping with vacant land generally.
I just don't understand why you picked 20 years. Why not? Why should there be a limit on when they were established?
So what we're trying to do is look at what the recently platted lots and the likelihood of them developing. So if something had been platted within the last 20 years, we don't expect to find a lot that's past the last 3 or 5 years. And the example that you raised, Jim, those plats, those lots in the rural area, in order to be a legal lot, you had to have been, a lot of those weren't as part of a plat. If they had been part of a plat that was recorded, we recognize them as legal. Those were done when you could just do a lot segregation. So it wouldn't really fall into these platted lots.
Okay, well, there may be someone else that has more knowledge on this than I have.
But sure.
Okay, other questions or comments on this one?
This is Jerry Olson. How are you differentiating between building lots that have lot numbers and were intended for buildings and tracts that were created? We've created a lot of tracts on plats that would meet this criteria.
Great question. Yeah, great question. Bob, Jose or Bob Poole, can one of you respond to that? I think Bob Poole, you probably know best how the plats are, how you filter out those type of tracts.
We definitely track which are the tracts. It's with the assessor property type codes. And, you know, they have a zero value lot classification for the ones that have zero value because they're never going to develop. So, and we track that with also what type of tract it is, wetland or stormwater facility or open space. Does that answer your question?
Yes, for now. That's a good way of distinguishing them.
Thank you.
You know, the other thing we talked about with the 20-year thing, we kind of look at that, too, as a market factor, right? If it's not developing over 20 years, something weird's going on with that property. And maybe the homeowner's sitting on it or something.
When you're talking about small city lots, that's the thing we found out a couple times before, is a lot of these small lots get combined with another parcel to make a building site. The building might be only on one, but together they form one lot. So if it's been there for 10, 15 years and not built on, likely it's been combined with another lot.
Exactly. Some sort of market factor thing happened to it.
So this is where trying to draw a line where we're picking up enough of these lots, like we're going back far enough that we're picking up things that, you know, might have just been a little slow, that got left behind in the initial set of home building, but also not going so far back that everybody's double lot is being counted as if it is, you know, the same as a fresh, newly platted lot. So that's where the 20-year cutoff came from. And other lots, the piece that's not listed explicitly here, but other vacant land, we are not recommending changing the size threshold for other vacant land. So that means that older lots that are 5,000 square feet or greater would still be in that vacant pool with the larger lots. And it's just lots that are under 5,000 square feet and platted more than 20 years ago would be considered built. Any other questions or comments on this one? Okay. All right, moving to the next one. The building value threshold for vacant. So right now, $13,000 of building value is the cutoff for things to be considered vacant. That threshold hasn't been updated since 2000. It doesn't vary with parcel size. If you'll recall, we looked at a lot of other possibilities for this, but at the end of the day, when we looked at the building value itself, actually most of the things that are converting and a lot of the ones that are in this kind of vacant category have zero building value. It's not a low number, but just zero. And so the 13,000 cutoff seems like it was still fairly reasonable as of 2007. So our refined recommendation, I guess, and the other thing, which Bob Poole can speak to more if folks have questions, but some of the other assessors data that we looked at, some of the more descriptive items from assessors data were not as reliable. They're not applied as consistently, maybe not updated as reliably. But the building value obviously is important to establishing people's taxes. So that gets, updated and is something that they put a fair amount of effort into getting that as right as they can. Not perfect, but it is, you know, it's at least a thing that they are paying attention to. And then based on looking back, that $13,000 threshold seems like a reasonable cutoff. And so our recommendation is just to do an annual adjustment based on how property values are changing for existing development in the county. And Bob Poole is going to do a little bit more work on this with the assessors to figure out the best way best source of data for that indexing, but to tie it not to consumer price index or construction cost indexing or anything like that, but to tie it to the actual fluctuation in property value over time. So questions or comments about that refined recommendation?
Jerry Olson again. Bob, how do mobile homes fit in this assessment value, or do they?
Mobile homes are counted on their value in determining vacant.
I'm sorry?
Yes, the mobile home value is considered building value, and we consider that. We sum up all the value of buildings on the property called that $13,000 okay. cutoff.
So the $13,000 could be a mobile home?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
And Ron Barca, I see you've raised your hand. What's your question?
I am looking at this and wondering, so this is the threshold specifically for vacant property. So we're saying that any building value of $13,000 will say that it is not vacant, it's occupied. Are we expecting then there to be no future movement on property that's in this category?
So I'd like to speak to that. Okay.
Sure. Yeah, I'm just going to offer a quick clarification that above that threshold would go to underutilized, and then there's a different threshold for underutilized where it would be considered built. But just because it's above 13,000 doesn't mean nothing is assumed to happen with it. But Bob, we'll go ahead and please offer some clarifications and additional comments there.
Thank you. Sorry for interrupting. In addition to that, the importance of this boundary between vacant and underutilized is what we'll be talking about today, which is the market factor differs depending on which one of those categories it falls into. That's all I wanted to add.
Okay. So it seems like, you know, as we look at the bar charts that are showing clear delineations and something that's either vacant or underutilized, it appears to me what we're really trying to do, though, is create some sort of transition planning or viewpoint that the intensity of the use of the property in relationship to the value of the building is going to show that there is movement. Because it seemed to me that we saw actually a fair amount of turnover on places where buildings had quite a bit of value. In the $50,000 to $100,000 range, there was still movement, and there was movement even above that. So I'm just trying to clarify. So the thought process is that this threshold is considered vacant. From $13,001, it becomes underutilized up to some point. Is that the intention?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep. And so that underutilized category is intended to capture things that are not strictly vacant, but also have potential for additional development. And that kind of gets to our market factor, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But that market factor for underutilized, we're not assuming as much likelihood of development on underutilized land as we are on vacant land. And so that's where that threshold matters, is to make sure that the things that are really there, there's no reason why somebody wouldn't develop them, that those are all being categorized as vacant, and that things where sure, it might be developed, but also, you know, somebody might have a different plan for that property. They might continue to use it as it is, that those are categorized as underutilized generally. And then we also, beyond underutilized, there is redevelopment, obviously, that's happened on more highly valued properties. And that's sort of a third category, is where the property itself is maybe has a use on it, but it also can be redeveloped. And we'll come back to redevelopment at a future meeting. But as you said, this one is just trying to identify land, make that differentiation between vacant and underutilized. And I see Eric Galamo, you've got a question or comment here.
Yeah, so when you're looking at the threshold, are you basing it on a per acre or per parcel?
The vacant threshold is per parcel. We looked at per acre, but I guess it's not clear that that does a better job of identifying land that will sort of function like vacant land. Very large lots that have, you know, a minimal amount of development that is slightly more than 13,000 certainly do exist and have a lot of development potential. But most of those we found had a house on them, and unless that house had the value zeroed out, most of those they did seem to have a lower likelihood of development than parcels that were truly vacant.
it probably doesn't matter as much for vacant, but for underutilized, a lot of times there's an economy of scale associated with it. And if you have a larger parcel and the cost of the home that's on it is less than the... I was coming out there. If there's a parcel that has the home value is less than the land, a lot of times the home will be taken down. So there's kind of an economy of scale where you do look at the scale of the parcel.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where the underutilized definition uses a building value per acre of land to try to pick those situations up. But because the things that have a unit, even if they also have a lot of land, did show a lower likelihood of developing than, you know, a similar size property without a unit on it. That's where we ended up recommending keeping a building value cutoff rather than building value per acre.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Okay. One of our, let's see, Stephen, I think that was you. I think I just had to mute you. So if you, I'm going to cautiously hit unmute, and if so that you have the opportunity to speak up if you have questions, but I would say be cautious with the computer audio because it can produce an echo. Okay. Any other questions or comments on this one? Okay. Next up. The lot size threshold for underutilized. So this is thinking about whether smaller parcels that are under an acre should be considered underutilized in some cases rather than just vacant or built. When we looked at this category further, most of the land that was categorized as built and was in this we had previously talked about considering only things that were at least a half acre, so in that half acre to 1 acre range, and that had a fair amount of additional development potential. That was the conversation we had at the last meeting. And when we looked at the land that was in that band and that developed, the vast majority of it was in the Vancouver urban growth area. We looked at zoning and we looked at the DMA land use, which is a generalization of the comprehensive plan designation. And although there was a fair amount of development that happened in the urban low density designations, the urban high density designations in the Vancouver urban growth area did have a higher rate of redevelopment. And so the recommendation here is to establish a new classification for these lots, stick with the half acre to 1 acre size grouping that we talked about last time, but limit it to only the Vancouver urban growth area. Make sure we are not picking up anything with more than one existing dwelling unit on it, because none of those redeveloped that had more than one existing dwelling, and to limit it to the residential urban high land use, so the kind of medium and high density comprehensive plan designations. And then to assume a redevelopment rate in the 5% to 10% range for this classification, based on this, based on the fact that it's, you know, a little over 5% that converted over a 12-year period, if you were to straight line that, which is an abstraction that is common and never right, but a reasonable abstraction, that would put you at a little under 10% over a 20-year period. So questions or comments on that recommendation?
I don't know if you can hear me. This is Brian Snodgrass.
Yeah,
Becky, you're muted.
Good thing I had my video on, so you could tell I was trying to talk. Okay, I can, Brian, we can hear you, and Stephen Abramson, I've muted your computer because I think that was causing the feedback. I think you are also on by phone, so you should be able to unmute yourself on the phone. But go ahead, Brian. Brian, I think you are.
Felix muted.
I think you have yourself muted, Brian, on the computer.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm unmuted now.
There you go.
This is a reasonable recommendation, I think. It looks like it's based on a 12 years of history. And we're needing to project forward for 20 years. So I don't know how you make that calculation, but I would just suggest it be at the higher end of the range that you've got of the 5 and 10%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took 5.8% over 12 years and said if that was the same, if you just took, it was very simple, not compounding, just roughly 5.8% over 12 and then times 20 gives you a little under 10. So that is some idea of what it would be. But yes, so I think 10 over 20 years, it would be about 10%. If we think that there's more development potential than that, it could be a little bit higher. 5% would seem like it's probably lower than the observed trend. Ron Barca, do you have a question or comment?
My comment is on the concept of only utilizing this in the Vancouver urban growth area. I think that the cities have matured to the point that the amount of residential development happening in Camas, Ridgefield, Battleground is such that we're going to start seeing more and more pockets. And I don't see any downside to including all of the urban areas within the county for this same type of underutilized definition.
Okay. And would you suggest that it also focus on the residential high density land designations?
I think that that could become more of a policy matter for the council, but I think in the concept of starting to look at the overall densities of the county, it's important for all of the urban areas to be contributing in some ways. And there's lots of significance that are being excluded because they don't sow in the rest of the development around themselves, but they'll become more and more obvious as underutilized parcels. So I think that if we went in with a position that said they would be urban high and then allowed input at that regard, I think that's good, robust discussion, but I don't see a reason to exclude them right out of the chute.
Okay. Anyone else have comments on this recommendation?
Jerry Olson again. I'm sorry, but I don't have a raise my hand, but
that's okay.
I will make a comment that'll be consistent for me as sort of as we go along on very similar issues, in that it appears to me that there's probably 120 residential units that existed on those 79 acres that were lost and they need to be accounted for.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's a good point, and that is something we've talked about, but it wasn't captured in those notes. I think that is appropriate for us to assume that if 5 to 10% of acres redevelop, you know, whatever percentage of acres we develop, that a similar percentage of the unit would be subtracted out of, so that we would be counting net, the net increase on those properties rather than assuming that that unit remains.
Yeah, I'm not saying that, but the deduction needs to be made. Or we mm-hmm. need to add supply to create those that loss of 120 units.
Okay. Other questions or comments on this one? Jim Malinowski, are you trying to raise hand and comment on this one?
Yes, right. I think I would support Mr. Barca's comments. It doesn't make sense to me that you restrict this kind of analysis to just Vancouver. You have a number of other residential urban areas, and I don't know why they shouldn't be treated the same as Vancouver.
Yeah, I think our thinking was just that there's not really an observed trend of it happening in a substantial enough way that that it seems like, you know, if a couple acres, you know, a couple properties of this are developing in other UGAs, that we're not missing a lot of units that way. That we might need to sort of calibrate that. What percentage do we assume redevelop separately for these, and that there's not much to go on. If we have, you know, 1.1 acres in Camas, that's probably two parcels. So there's not much to go on to say how common is this likely to be. That's the difficulty of trying to add it in the other UGAs. I would say that's certainly something, even if the ultimate recommendation was to start with this only in the Vancouver UGA, that's something that the county could revisit at the next point where you update the methodology to say, you know, is there enough data and evidence in the other communities to base a recommendation on to include them in that? Other questions or comments?
So this is Ron Barca, just to try and close this thing out from my own understanding. I don't understand the downside of including them. Is it just a matter that the data is muddy and it would be difficult to ascertain what's genuinely there?
Because we would have a harder time with putting together a chart like this that would say how much of the total property in this size range, you know, that meets this criteria would we expect to develop. We don't really have enough information to set a good assumption for the other UGAs. So we could use a single assumption, but I'm guessing that this is at least more common, more frequent in Vancouver than it is in the others. We don't really know for sure. But the risk would be, are we overestimating the capacity in the other UGAs by assuming, let's say, 10% of the land in this category would redevelop? So I think that's the trade-off, is we could end up overestimating if we were to apply this to all of the UGAs.
It doesn't seem, with the numbers that we're dealing with and the good data that Bob Poole has been able to bring forward, it doesn't really seem like that's a big risk as I'm seeing it, but perhaps there's some more explanation that would clarify for me at a later time. I don't need to go into it now.
Okay. All right, thanks. Any other questions or comments on this topic before we move on? Okay. So next up is market factor. So our first introduction to market factor in a formal way, although it's, you know, kind of come up a little bit in some of our other conversations. Bob Perker is going to give an introduction with some of the background of the state guidance on this front, what's new there. And then Jose is going to talk to us a little bit about current practice in the county.
Greetings. So market factors have been a part of the billable lands program since its inception, and the purpose is to recognize that not all land will be available during planning horizon to make adjustments to that to provide an adequate supply. So effectively what we're trying to do is to identify reductions in the amount of land suitable for development and redevelopment over the planning period. The 2018 guidebook provided additional clarification on market factors, and one of the key pieces of guidance that came out of the guidebook was basically show your work. So do additional analysis and provide evidence that supports whatever market factor assumptions that you build into your buildable lands report. The kinds of things that we would consider, and Becky, can you go on to the next slide now? And the market factor include infrastructure costs, the cost of development, permitting timelines, market availability, economic conditions to achieve proposed densities, and just overall market demand. So for example, we saw a big drop off in market demand for development after the 2008 housing crisis. It's likely that we might see a similar pattern emerge out of the economic impacts from the ongoing pandemic right now. So we've been working internally with staff over the past weeks to pull together analysis that helps us better understand the dynamics that have been going on and arrive at what we think is a useful set of data analysis to inform a recommendation. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jose to talk a little bit about what the county's done in the past.
Okay, so the county has used a number to convert factor, like we've talked about earlier. So for the vacant land that we've identified, we assume that 10% of that won't develop, and the underutilized 30% won't develop in over the 20-year horizon. We've also, and this is on the supply side, so we're not counting land that we have currently because we don't think they're going to develop. On the demand side, when we get the population projections from the state and we try to determine how much land we need, going back to 1994, the councils or boards at the time have added some market factor, sort of increasing the amount of supply of land. So in 1994, it was the first comp plan, a lot of uncertainty about how much land was actually going to be needed, the first time we were going to have a limit, and the market factor that the board came up with at the time was a 25% market factor and also a 5% error factor related to the modeling. In 2004, the different council, different interest in trying to focus on employment. So you see there was zero market factor or error factor. Well, error factor was only used in 1994, but the focus was on kind of employment, and you have the 25% market factors for commercial industrial business park there. You know, 07 was sort of an extension of the 2004 plan where so the development community, some folks didn't think that there was enough land that was added in the 04 plan. So we did a rather large expansion then with a 10% additional market factor. And then in 2016, the most recent comp plan, there was a 15% market factor that was used across the board for residential and non-residential land. So
that's kind of how we've historically used both the never to convert and the demand side, and that sort of makes up holistically our market factor.
Okay. So hold on a second. Our Bob Poole put some data together for us that is the closest we can come to a 20-year look at this, and compared the model growth vacant acres and gross underutilized acres of residential land as of the 1996 model, and then compared in that same geography, so within the same 1996 urban growth area, what does the 2019 modeling say about how much land is vacant and underutilized? So not everything that is left as of 2019 is due to market factor. There are a couple other things at play there. It's not a precise indicator, but it's the best data that we have at the moment. And then there are specific factors in Ridgefield and Yakult that staff can talk more about if folks have questions, but that make that data a little less reliable for this purpose. It is generally fine, but that make it less useful for trying to interpret market factor. So just to give an example of what this looks like, this is a piece of the Ridgefield urban growth area from 1996. The yellow is vacant, the peachy color is underutilized, and then the slightly darker version of those are the critical land within those categories. And then that same blue outline of where the UGA was in 1996. If we look at that land as of 2019, you can see that there are, you know, fairly large chunks of it that are now built. And so that is picking up land that was vacant or was underutilized, and it's now showing up in the built category in the 2019 buildable lands model. There are also a couple of little things that are, this is sort of an example of not everything that is left being market factor, but there are some of these properties that previously were considered underutilized as in the 1996 BBLM and are now classified as vacant. That could be a variety of things. It could be a structure was torn down. It could be a structure floated below that 13,000 cutoff or whatever the cutoff was at that time. So there are a couple reasons for that, but that type of thing does happen where a given property might shift from one category to another without necessarily being developed. And that can make this a little bit less, again, a little bit less reliable for trying to interpret this difference as a indicator of market factor. But what we found from that data set was that on the vacant land countywide and on all of the urban growth areas, that 30% of the, let me say this carefully, so that compared to the amount of vacant land that was in that same boundary in 1996, the amount of land that was vacant as of 2019 is 30% of what the total was in 1996. And the balance is now in a different category. And then for underutilized land, as of 2019, within that same 1996 boundary, 43% as much land is underutilized as there was in 1996. And then we can compare that against the assumptions that Jose talked about with the never to convert market factor and error factor that were applied at the 1994 point And generally these numbers are falling kind of in between the never to convert factor that is in the buildable lands model and the total if you were to combine that with the market factors that are applied on the demand side. So I'm going to pause on this because I know this is a little bit of a complicated analysis and just ask if there are clarifying questions about how this works today or the analysis that we did before we move on to any sort of recommendations or additional discussion. Any clarifying questions on this?
I have one. This is Brian Snodgrass.
Go ahead, Brian.
I just looking at the data and the 30% and the 43. Do you guys have an estimate of how much of that is one side going to the other? In other words, a vacant land converting to underutilized or less likely underutilized converting to vacant? I mean, is that just sort of a negligible amount or is it a significant amount?
It's a good question. Bob Poole and Margaret, I know we looked at this a little bit, and I'm not sure if I'd have to look back and see if the data we have, if it's appropriate to use for at that level of granularity, but I think we can break that out at that level. Margaret or Bob Poole, do you have any comment on that?
We're aggregating this at the different levels. When you start overlaying specific parcels going back to 96, you get the whole parcel shift thing getting wrapped up into that, and it just gets messier and messier. So these are pretty good numbers. You know, this is our model at that time and date versus our model today. And I don't think it's a bad thing that things switch from underutilized to vacant. That's a pretty, you know, very low threshold. That's kind of what happens.
And I think we could look, we could try to parse that out a little bit. That's something we might need to take a look at it and discuss internally whether whether it would make sense to separate out stuff that switched back and forth just between vacant and underutilized. But it is, it's hard. We're not, this isn't on a parcel by parcel basis. It's just, in aggregate because of the shift that Bob Poole mentioned where the actual spatial alignment in the map in the GIS software shifted a little bit and that makes it very difficult to go back in time and say for a given piece of land what is it today, what was it in 1996, because it is like 50 feet to the left of where it was in 1996 if you ask the GIS.
Yes.
Bob, well, did you want to say more about that?
This other thing is, this analysis we did really looked even at what's today's comp plan, right? Because if you look at back at 96, the comp plans were even different. So we just kind of picked a cookie cutter to go back and say what happened, what's the difference. Does this get us in the ballpark of market factor? And of that stuff that's left from those old UGAs and even the city centers, what's left? Now, why aren't those things converting? And we're seeing they actually are converting relatively quickly now. So it seems like it's a good estimate. It seems like we're in the ballpark with market factor. I'm not sure teasing out things that are just shifting from the underutilized column to the vacant column, if that's really changing these numbers much because they're general numbers to begin with.
Okay. I see Eric and Ron have hands raised. Do you guys have clarifying questions or more general comments?
Go ahead, Eric.
So before the meeting, I sent out a few excerpts from previous presentations, and there's one. I don't know if I can share it on the screen or not. I could try, maybe while Ron's talking. But what it kind of shows is that even in times like back when we had a huge shortage of lots, the model was still showing we had a significant amount of inventory. And I think that's what the market factor is supposed to be showing. And I'm not sure that it is high enough. And I think there's a lot of stuff that's not converting. But it's not always just pure to market. I think a lot of times it's due to not funding the infrastructure improvements necessary to serve the property.
And Eric, your email is posted online. I understand the attachments did not get included in that file on the first try, but they are folks are working on that, so that your files will be available for download. If they're not right now, they'll be available for download for members of the committee if they want to take a look at the materials that you provided.
So I'm not sure if there's a thing here where you can share things. You mind if I try it? I don't want to mess up the presentation, but I think you can probably boot it off if it doesn't work.
I think it only allows sharing one at a time, and my preference would be to keep going through the presentation. Jose, maybe you can double check if the comments are now updated, and if they are, then folks could potentially just download them from online if they want to take a look at it during the meeting. Does that work for you, Eric?
Yeah, I'm checking it.
Sure, that's fine.
Okay. It looks like I don't know if they're updated yet, but we will make sure that they are accessible to everybody. And we have a couple more slides on market factor, but Ron, did you have a clarifying question on this one before we go forward?
Yeah, I just think with the discussion about the underutilized and the 30% never convert, with the data we have, even going forward, the concept of being able to track what is utilized, because it seems it's part of the natural entropy of the underutilized to move away from being underutilized to vacant and then converting. And I think that's probably an important trend for us to be able to pull out on a more annual basis to clarify over a period of time on whether the market factor is the right number or not. 30% never to convert seems like over 20 years, it seems like there's been pressure just about everywhere to convert as long as the urban growth boundary continues to move. And I'd be really surprised if over that period of time we haven't just seen a lot of the property migrate over into the vacant. But I don't have the data. And so I think that would be something really important for us to go forward with the assumption we're going to start looking at the data on a more annual basis.
All right, so I'm going to run through the last couple slides on market factor, and then we can have some additional discussion on this. Okay, so we also took a look at how this varies by urban growth area. I mentioned that Ridgefield and Yakult kind of have their own situations going on, but generally for the other urban growth areas, Vancouver, you're seeing a higher, you're seeing less land that is still vacant as of 2019 relative to how much was vacant in 1996, but it is not, so there's a difference there. It's not a massive difference, but there is a difference. And then for underutilized, again, there's some of the areas have a difference, but not a lot of difference from Vancouver for the most part, with a couple of exceptions. And so our the team's initial conclusions were that given that this data is not perfect, it seems like the current factors are roughly aligned with the observed trends. So if we think about the 10 and 30% never to convert factors, and then the most recent market factor of 15%, not the larger ones that were applied in 1994, but the most recent one, those are not too far off from what the ballpark of what we see looking back. And that I think it's important to remember that the planning assumptions are intentionally creating some surplus in the system. There's been there's been a demand side market factor built in addition to the 10 and 30%. And every year except for 2004, when that was sort of corrected in 2007. We're seeing that in the data as we look back. And so our initial recommendation was not to change those never to convert factors that are in the model, and then to consider an additional market factor up to about 15% on the demand side going forward. So other questions and comments on this topic?
Jerry Olson again. I think it's important to remember that the never to convert really is not never. It's only for a period of 20 years. And we in the industry meet the landowners and we meet the people that do the converting. So it's not surprising to us that these are higher numbers.
Okay. And Eric, do you have another comment that you want to share?
Yeah, so is the recommendation then to just do the same thing that we've done in the last segment, or is it to go 15% higher?
No, this recommendation would be to keep the 10 and 30 and then the demand side market factor to continue to be at council discretion based on the type of factors that are listed in the guidance, and that based on kind of observed patterns that up to 15% seems to be supported by historical data, but that if council, that council is making that determination, and that if they thought that the other considerations that are mentioned in the guidelines were, that there was a reason to go above that, that they could potentially do that. But the, what we see in the data is up to about 15% is probably justifiable based on that, based on the observed historical data.
So I kind of agree with what Jerry said. It's not never to convert. It's in that next 20-year period. And what we're seeing is a lot of the stuff that's converting now was not even from the last comp plan. It was from a comp plan or two ago. And it finally is economically feasible for those parties or those properties to develop. And it sometimes takes time. And if you look at that chart I think I sent over, which I don't know if I can pop it up or not. It's just one slide. But it basically shows historically – back when we had a huge lot shortage in like 2003 through 2006, that the model still showed almost 2/3 of our land supply still available. And that seems like something was broken in that factor where it wasn't available.
Jerry Olson again. I was assuming you were adding the 15 to the 10 and the 30, but...
Correct.
The numbers that you showed historically were closer to what we've been projecting based on what we see in the field about people just not selling their land.
Did that work? Can you see it?
Yeah.
So this is a chart, and the county prepared this. It was in one of the work sessions talking about the vacant buildable lands model. And what it shows is it really never goes below that probably 45,000 level, even though it kind of trends in that 65 down to 45, and it never really goes below it. There's almost like a base flow or a baseline. And I can unshare that now, but I think it's just a hit of a button.
I guess, is there something about that you think helps us think about a different number for market factor?
I do. It kind of shows, like, how many lots of the capacity is kind of brought up and down in a typical cycle.
Okay.
And I guess like back in that time period in between like 2000 and, you know, 2006, was there a huge shortage that drove prices way up, but the model's still showing that we had, you know, 45,000 lots out of 65,000, probably in the capacity that's still available.
Okay. So, I guess the question I would have is, does that point you, how would we use that, to inform, the market factor assumptions? I think there's a lot of other things going on in that capacity number besides market factor. And I see the pattern that you're describing, but I'm trying to figure out how that would, become part of a market factor determination. Is there additional clarification that you can provide there?
Well, I think there's a story behind that chart too. I mean, it's not all market factor, but the reality is that's really what did not, of the capacity in the system, it shows what didn't develop. And a lot of that is not just market, not someone unwilling to sell. It's that they're unwilling to sell at that price, or it's not economically feasible to develop. And that's something that's not in our model really, because what's happening, and I can say one example is the area south of Battleground that needed tremendous amount of pump stations and infrastructure. Even though it was brought in the growth boundary, it was brought in with a utility plan. There was no mechanism to fund it. So it was never economically viable to develop that property. So it sat there for 20 years plus. It's still sitting there today, a lot of it.
And so, I think that's the type of factor that the guidelines suggest using or considering in establishing a market factor. I think these are all relevant points. I think they make sense. I think the hard part is just to figure out how any of these things, I mean, even the guidebook also does not clarify how thinking about the factors that they have identified gets you to a number exactly. So I think those are things that are worth taking into consideration. And I was just curious if you had a specific set of data that you thought would point to a different number, but that's helpful. And Jose tells me that the link with your comments is now updated to include the attachment. So if folks want to take another look at that chart, they can do so by downloading it from the materials that are online.
Becky, this is Bob Parker. Can I make a comment?
Please.
So I think what's embedded in that is likely to be the kind of things that the state envisions a market factor would include. Infrastructure costs, cost of development, permitting processes, market availability of land, economic conditions, market demand, all those things. And as we were going through and doing the analysis, we had the exact discussion of, is it possible to tease out the relative contribution of these different factors? And is it, two questions, is it possible and is it required? And the answer to both of those is really functionally no. It's really difficult to look at a landscape level and determine which of these factors might be affecting the developability of land. And from a planning perspective, we know how infrastructure works. It can take years from the point where a piece of property is brought into a UGA to where it makes sense to service it. And I think that's exactly the kind of activity that the state is trying to account for in the market factor assumptions.
Okay, any other questions or comments on market factor at this point? This is our first conversation on it. We're not trying to wrestle it to the ground to a final recommendation, but if there are other thoughts or comments that folks want to make, we can take a few more of those before we move on to the infrastructure gaps piece. Okay, hearing none. I'm going to move up to infrastructure gap. And again, Bob Parker is going to give a little bit of background and kind of context of what the state guidelines have, and Jose is going to speak a little bit to how what the county's done on this so far.
Yeah, so this is a new element, as everybody's aware, that came out of the state legislation. And effectively, it is recognizing the fact that jurisdictions may have infrastructure gaps that may preclude development. So the idea is to evaluate and identify land suitable for development that doesn't have infrastructure gaps, and to consider factors like the lack of urban development on pieces of property within the billable lands, base infrastructure plans, and the likelihood that development will occur quickly once infrastructure is available. We considered a number of different approaches to doing this, and the guidebook says look at things like capital improvement programs and so on, and ultimately came to the conclusion that the local experts are probably going to be able to give us the best guidance on what's happening in their jurisdiction. So I'll let Jose talk a little bit about what our approach is and where we're at in that part of the process.
Thanks, Bob. So I've sent a letter out to all of the cities asking for them to give us some feedback on whether they think they have any infrastructure gaps in their jurisdictions. You know, outside of what they're planning for within the 20-year comp plan, because the assumption is that most of the areas can be served within 20 years. I'd ask to get some feedback back by the 18th. I've only heard from one jurisdiction, which is Richfield, and they don't feel like they have any infrastructure gaps. I will follow up with the other jurisdictions to get their perspective on that and then bring that back for the group, for the group's consideration going forward. Any questions on that?
So, yeah, I know there's not too much to respond to there, but any questions or comments about the way we're proposing to approach this? Okay, hearing none. We'll see if we hear anything back. We'll give you guys an update at the next meeting. But I think if we don't hear anything else from the cities, the assumption will be that there are not any infrastructure gaps that need to be accounted for in the model. So next thing on our agenda, and we're a little bit ahead of schedule, I might let you guys off of this early, which would be nice because I know being on a conference call for this long can be at least as hard as sitting in a room for this long. The next thing on our agenda is public comment. I know we have at least one or two people. Are you still on the line? Yes, I see Susan. And I think there's at least one other person on the line who's not a member of the committee. If you would like to speak up, you can have 3 minutes to make a comment or submit any additional comments in writing. So does anyone want to make a comment? Okay, I'm hearing none. Susan, or I believe that's Ellen. I will take it that you do not have comments at this time. Feel free to continue submitting written material. So last thing on our agenda is just a little bit of a look ahead to the next meeting. So our next meeting is scheduled to be the final one on this kind of batch of topics. So we'll bring back the conversation about redevelopment and And then follow up on other topics today that came up today, such as the market factor. And then we'll also bring in a little more information about mixed use and redevelopment on of residential and commercial lands, because I think that that will help us think through the redevelopment piece. So those are some of the things we're planning to bring back. Our plan at this point is to most likely bring back the employment land classification piece as part of talking about capacity, because we wanted to kind of merge those two together. So this is what we're planning on for the next meeting, and then having kind of a wrap up where we would just kind of confirm our recommendations on the residential land classifications and some of the other topics that we feel like we've got reasonably good agreement on so far. So next meeting, fingers crossed for us to be in human form, but if not, we will try this again. And we'll be trying to do some votes if we can, and we'll confirm with Chris, with our legal advice, that we can do formal votes over the internet. But I think that may be what we need to do. So we'll see, and we'll hope to have you join us for the next meeting, one way or the other. Again, fingers crossed that maybe it'll be in person. Jose, anything you want to add before we sign off?
That captures it. I think we're scheduled for our next meeting is on May 1st. And so
I think that's right.
Right. Kind of depending on where we are with the situation, we might be back to this format. Hopefully, the conversation was it's best we can do for now, but I really appreciate you participating and coming, joining us, and look forward. We'll keep you updated on how we're going to move forward. So stay tuned.
All right. And with that, I think we will sign off and say thank you for managing through this with us for an hour and a half. We'll have the recording up online, and we will talk to you again in a month and a half or so. So thank you all for participating. If you have any comments about the experience of participating in this meeting, and anything that you think that would make it better if we do have to use this technology again, feel free to send those to Jose and he'll share them with us. So thanks very much for your time and attention, and stay safe. Goodbye.